The United States v. Jamieson.
Good afternoon, Your Honors. Matt Worsen for Dennis Jamieson. Why don't we start off by just marveling at how difficult it was for the United States to obtain a conviction in this case. You have a college-educated loan officer with not a criminal record, whose only crime is to possess an antique sawed-off shotgun, possesses that through marriage for over 20 years, and this antique sawed-off shotgun is simply in the marital home. The defendant is a gun enthusiast. So indeed, the United States had a very difficult case. And so how did it obtain a conviction? How is it that now Dennis Jamieson is in federal prison for 3 years for this offense? And the way the United States did it, Your Honor, is through introducing unfairly prejudicial evidence which provoked this jury's instinct to punish Dennis Jamieson. And the United States painted my client as a potential physically abusive to his wife.
Look, you know, I was reading your brief, and I just didn't understand why you maintain that the domestic violence inquiry is unfounded. The fact is that the wife told the authorities that her husband raised a hand to her. Now, you know, maybe that statement was accurate, maybe it wasn't, but there isn't any dispute that she made the statement. So why wasn't the government entitled to ask her about it?
2 points, Your Honor. The first one is that in the government's case in chief, all the evidence established that there was no domestic violence. It's only at the point where Ms. Jamieson is put on the stand that the whole issue is raised. Now, she did make those statements, there's no question. However, she recanted them.
She may have recanted them, but she said her opinion as to her husband's aggressiveness wasn't based on any specific incident, but rather her knowledge of his character.
Judge Rovner, I think this all begs the question, though. Wasn't this evidence unfairly prejudicial? Whether or not it's so put aside whether it's founded or not. Let's examine whether or not it meets the standard of Rule 403. And we would say, based on one point, it is not. And that is, bias evidence doesn't just always come in on cross-examination.
No, but once she testifies that she lied when she told the Sheriff's Department that Mr. Jamieson had raised a hand to her in order to intimidate her, but allowed that he was an aggressive person, why shouldn't the government be entitled to ask her why she thinks he's aggressive? She's disclaiming an earlier statement to the authorities, which supported the whole theory of the government that she's testifying on his behalf because she's intimidated by him. Why isn't it appropriate for the government to be able to probe further?
Because, Your Honor, the government already established that this witness was biased in favor of the defendant. The government elicited right at the outset of its cross-exam that she was married to the defendant, living with the defendant, and biased in favor of the defendant. That being established, why did the government need this evidence?
Because what do they need to help you for?
No, well, they don't need to help us,
this is a new view.
No, my client has the benefit of Rule 403.
That's the judge's best friend. Only if the judge wants to use it.
Correct. And our position, Your Honor, is that under Rule 403, this evidence should have never come in. The primary point is that bias was already established. a secondary point would be that how is this evidence at all relevant to the crime charged? It simply is not.
Of course it is, because the government is exploring whether she might be testifying on her husband's behalf because she's terrified of him.
But, Your Honor, that's to establish bias, which our position is that there's no need to establish bias. It was established right at the outset of the cross-examination. We also submit that under Rule 403, this evidence had marginal relevance, if any. What element of the crime did this evidence go to? It simply didn't go to any. The government argues in its brief that the evidence, it was critical to rebut this possession issue. However, that's a non-starter. That element of the crime was essentially conceded below. The element where all the action was at the trial court was knowledge. Did this defendant have the knowledge of the characteristics of this gun that brought it within the statute?
Look, the day we say that the government doesn't have the right to explore whether a witness may be testifying because that witness fears the defendant, we're in big trouble.
Well, then I guess I would go back and try to persuade Your Honor that, in fact, this is unfounded. The case in chief, this evidence that somehow Dennis Jameson is violent towards his wife, what's the evidence of that?
That she told the sheriff's police that he raised his hand to her.
And our position is that Miss Jameson was off her medication. She said a lot of things and did a lot of things.
Well, but the jury heard all that.
It is our position, and I'll just restate it, that under Rule 403, and I guess let's talk about the Thompson case, which we simply can't, we submit that this court can't have the rule, the broad rule that bias evidence on cross always comes in. The Thompson case doesn't say that. The holding in Thompson is that Rule 403 applies. And so our position here is that Rule 403 does apply. I mean, the order that the government is seeking in this case is that broad.
Look, you have to look at this precise case. She tells the sheriff's police he raises his hand to her. She gets on the stand. She's being cross-examined. She says she lied, while at the same time acknowledging that he's a very aggressive person. At that point, asking her why she thought the defendant was aggressive is a logical follow-up question. And if you'd been the prosecutor, you would have asked that question because you're real smart.
Well, we respectfully disagree because the bias was established, and his aggression, whether it's there or not, doesn't speak to any elements of the crime. It's immaterial. It's highly prejudicial.
It's not particularly prejudicial, seems to me. Her answer was, I'm not basing it on any, specific incident. You know, it's just sort of his character. He's sort of aggressive.
And yet the government, in its closing argument, refers to the week of domestic violence. How is that not prejudicial? This jury, maybe it's not explicitly prejudicial, but the inference that the government was seeking to have drawn was that Dennis Jameson was a bad guy and potentially bad towards his wife. And that's how the conviction was obtained in this case.
It's always a problem when you put someone on the stand and they tell a whole new story. And that's what, you know, that's what she did.
Well, we disagree, and I guess I'd just be repeating the points I've already made. Am I into my rebuttal time?
Yeah. Oh, yes.
Okay, I'll save a little time.
Thank you, Mr. Worsley.
If I have any.
Yeah, now you'll have rebuttal time.
Okay, great.
Mr. Schmidt?
Good afternoon. May it please the Court, Donald Schmidt for the United States of America.
The context of this case, and the reason it was really a surprise for it even to go to trial, is that the evidence before trial and that was presented at trial was that the defendant himself admitted that this was his sawed-off shotgun, that he had purchased it, that he had fired it, and that he knew it was illegal because it was too short.
You know, in terms of Mr. Jameson's knowledge, I'd like to clarify a point that I saw raised in Mr. Jameson's brief. Under Staples, the government has to prove that Mr. Jameson was specifically aware of the physical characteristics of the gun that rendered it subject to the registration requirement, but not that he was aware of the registration requirement itself?
That's exactly right, Your Honor. Staples says and stands for the proposition that a person doesn't have to know that the gun has to be registered. Rather, the person has to know of the special characteristics of the gun that ultimately subject it to registration. And here, in this particular case, Mr. Jameson himself admitted that he knew the gun was too short, and hence it was, in his shorthand, illegal. In another instance, he said to one of the deputies that had been on the scene during the week of domestic disputes that the gun was a novelty, and he knew it was probably too short. In addition to the defendant's own admissions to the ATF agents that it was his gun and he knew it was too short, the defendant's wife said it was his gun. She brought it into the police and not only told the police it was his gun, but she actually gave a sworn statement to the police under pains of penalties of perjury that it was his gun. Then 2.5 weeks later, she was interviewed by two ATF agents and said again, it was his gun, I gave it to the police. So the evidence was very strong, and yet the case goes to trial, and the very first defense witness is Mrs. Jameson, and she comes and says, no, I was lying. I didn't really mean that. I wasn't telling the truth. It was really my gun. I had inherited it. At that point, the government, on cross-examination, established a number of points. First, that she was still married to the defendant, and they were now back living together. But there's nothing in the case law that says the government is limited to only 2 points of bias if, in fact, there are 3 or 4 or 5. Indeed, if the defendant had put his gun to the defendant's head, to Mrs. Jameson's head, right before trial and said, you're going to testify this way, Mrs. Jameson.
I don't think he would call her Mrs. Jameson.
Wife. The government was surely entitled to get at that. And this matter of foundation is puzzling because, as Your Honor pointed out, she had said that he had raised his hand, not just raised his hand to her, but to intimidate her. Plus, she said under oath, in a volunteered statement, that he is an aggressive person. And the government simply asked why. And in response to that why question, she really didn't give any prejudicial answers. She basically said, oh, there was nothing really to base it on, just kind of knowledge of his character. He has an aggressive personality. And that was really the end of it. In any event, even if the judge could arguably have said to have abused his discretion in this evidentiary ruling, and the United States doesn't believe there is any abuse of discretion in ruling this way, the government's case was really ironclad. The contradictory statements offered by the defense, both by Mr. Jameson and Mrs. Jameson, didn't overcome the overwhelming proof of the admissions of the defendant himself, the fact that the gun itself was one of the smallest that had ever been seen. The barrel, Your Honor, was simply 8 inches long, as opposed to 18 inches that it was supposed to be. To look at this gun, you knew it had the characteristic of being too short. Its overall length was 14 inches instead of 26 inches. Just holding this gun up during the trial, one could see it had the special characteristics. And the other thing that the government had to prove was that the defendant possessed it. And he denied that. He denied that in his testimony. He said, I didn't think it was my gun. He denied ownership of it at the transcript, page 264. He admitted he had fired it 15 years before, but what the indictment charged was possession in February of 2009 when Mrs. Jameson had turned the gun in. he acknowledged kind of cagily that he had fired it, but then he said he didn't know what had happened to the gun. He wouldn't have been able to find it, and he denied handling the gun after firing it 15 years ago, and he denied purchasing the gun at trial. So possession, knowing possession, was very much an issue, and the government's proof was strong, but it was in issue, as was the Staples requirement of knowledge of that special characteristic. We think, Your Honors, that the district court made no error to admit this very logical question, and in any event, even if there had been an error, it would have been harmless, given the overwhelming nature and ironclad nature of the government's proof. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Schmidt. Mr. Warzer?
Just briefly on one point, and that is proof on the knowledge element, which was critical here, was simply not conclusive. Let me give a couple examples. Officer Shively, A16 in the appendix, did not recall the admission of defendant's knowledge of the illegality of the weapon. The federal agents, Bennett and Vance, admitted to not discussing the registration requirement with defendant. And then finally, defendant himself testified that over the years, he had asked a number of individuals, including a lawyer, whether or not this gun needed to be registered. And he came to the conclusion, based on these discussions, that it's an antique, and then therefore would fit within section 5845A8. That's in the record. All that evidence, the equivocal testimony of the government's case in chief, simply does not establish an ironclad case, especially on the intent element. Without further questions, we'll rest. Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Warzen. Thanks to both counsel. Mr. Warzen, I want to give you additional thanks to the court for accepting this appointment and ably representing.
It's my pleasure.
Yeah.
Case is taken under advisement. The court will stand in recess.